So good evening, everyone. Welcome to those who are here for the first time. Happy New Year to those I haven't said it to yet. This is our first Dharma seminar of the year. For those of you who may have just arrived not knowing this, this is the first night we do on Wednesday nights, 4 to 6 week series on a theme. And then we usually take a few weeks break in between each one. And this one I am entitling Difference and Unity, Encountering Injustice on the Bodhisattva Path. It seems like so many of the hot button topics in our society today are about difference. Not just difference, but differences in oppositional differences. Male and female, black and white, Christian, Muslim, and Jew. We could make a long list. And yet there's something in each of us, all of us, that yearns for unity, for connection, for belonging. We feel these divisions in the human family differently, depending on our status in relationships of power and privilege. Whether we have vested interests to defend or whether we want a fair slice of the pie. But don't all of us as human beings want basic respect? Care, love, acceptance, to be seen and heard fully for who we are. I don't know who first coined that phrase, the human family, and sometimes it seems a stretch of the imagination to even call it that. But for all our differences, we stem from the same source. Have you ever heard of the mitochondrial Eve? Anybody? Yeah, a few. So in 1987, a team of geneticists published the results of their worldwide survey of human mitochondrial DNA. So in case you're not sure what that is, mitochondrial DNA is the DNA that floats around within our cells outside the nucleus. Okay, so it's passed on through the matrilineal line. And it turns out we all go back to a single female ancestor who lived approximately 200,000 years ago, around the time that anatomically modern humans emerged. And so she's been dubbed the mitochondrial Eve. And I think it might be good for us to remember her as we look at the ways we humans have created divisions amongst ourselves. Throughout human history, we've been capable of both horrific cruelty and violence, as well as altruistic and creative acts that nourish connection. The trouble is that we direct our caring and affiliation mostly towards those who are like us, with whom we feel a kinship. And we tend to see those who are different from us as a threat. And this is a very old and natural and understandable aspect of our evolution going back to our pre-human origins. But at this point in human history, it's tearing us apart and endangering the survival not just of us humans, but of all beings on this earth. And this us-them mentality seems to be more accentuated during times of political and economic instability, like our own times. And now we have to add climate and environmental instability as well. So I think there's a deep underlying fear, much denied fear, beneath the vilifying of others that we see all around us in the world, and that's so evident in the media. But there's also an urgency in the voices that are calling us to find another way to be, another way to live on this earth together as kin, with an appreciation for the amazing diversity of expressions of human life, not to mention other beings with even more amazing diversity. But to truly say, as First Nations cultures do, all my relations. All my relations. I happen to think that the teachings of the Buddha give us some excellent practices and perspectives for doing that work. Of finding out how to live together on this earth. So, in the coming weeks, I thought we could share some possibilities. One of the fundamental Soto Zen texts in our chant books that we chant on a regular basis addresses this paradox of difference and unity and has some wisdom to offer, I think. It's called Sandokai in Japanese, or Sandongchi in Chinese, written by a Chinese Zen master, Shirdo, in the 8th century. And there are quite a few different translations for the title. Harmony of difference and equality, or merging of difference and unity, identity of relative and absolute. Those are just a few. But I think when I refer to it, I'll just call it the Sandokai. It's easier. And then I don't have to commit to one choice of translation. But the title is the same and comes from an earlier Taoist text in China. And it consists of three characters. San is the number three, which stands for the many. And Do is means sameness or oneness, so the many and the one. And Kai means merging of the two. Hence, merging or identity of difference and unity. And the poem describes poetically what are called in Buddhist thought the two truths, the truth of differentiation, the particularity of existence in the phenomenal world, and the truth of unity, of oneness, boundless interconnection. So sometimes that's called the relative and the absolute. And the message of this text is that these two truths are non-dual. They're not separate, but simultaneous and interpenetrating. This is kind of a challenging concept to wrap our heads around. And I think it's not so much a matter of understanding it as living it, embodying it, these two truths simultaneously. It would be easy to say, well, fine, difference and equality are not separate. But how does that relate to these divisions in our world and in our society today? Gender, sexuality being in the forefront right now, race, areas where injustice based on difference has caused so much suffering. Religion, I was going to add. So we're not going to study this poem in detail, but I might touch on it and use it as a guide in the coming weeks to explore how this perspective of difference and unity can help expand our capacity to respond to these painfully divisive issues with an open heart and mind. All these different ways we use to create hierarchies of power and privilege. So tonight I just want to look at the first few lines of the poem, which go, "The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors." Those are the first lines of the poem. So the great sage of India is, of course, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, whose teachings were transmitted from India to China, to Japan, and eventually here to us on the west coast of North America. So India was in the west of China, so the teachings came, the teachings were transmitted from west to east. So it's kind of ironic that we tend still to use a Eurocentric perspective in referring to our culture as the West, and China and Japan as the Far East. But as we know, horizons and points of reference shift as human knowledge and experience expands. And always there is that infinitely vast reality that includes all we know and all we don't know, in a dynamic flux. And that is the mind of the great sage of India. And it is transmitted every time we sit still, take our zazen posture, and sit with spacious awareness of body, mind, and world. No inside, no outside. This is transmission. It may be shared by teacher and student when both open into this spacious mind. It may be between you and a mountain, or a river, or a dragonfly. Maybe between you and someone very different from you. As Dogen Zenji, who founded our particular school of Zen in Japan, reminds us, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. What he's saying is that when we don't get in the way with our fixed habit patterns of thought and behavior, other beings come forth to meet us, to be seen and received, and to see and receive us in their thusness, in our thusness, just as we are. In most translations of that line, the mind of the great sage of India is transmitted from west to east. But in at least one other translation, it reads between west and east, and which is actually more accurate, given that the Chinese character used there implies a meeting, a mutuality, a transmission between two beings, which I think beautifully describes the relational aspect of the Dharma, of this practice. No one gets enlightened all by themselves. It's impossible, because we are not discrete, separate selves, because we only exist in a matrix of other beings and phenomena. When the Buddha had his enlightenment experience under the Bodhi tree, he declared, "I and all beings have awakened." So he couldn't have awakened without all beings. In our priest ordination, in our tradition, in our priest ordination or lay ordination ceremonies, there's a wonderful line that goes, "Only a Buddha and a Buddha can realize Buddhahood." Always takes at least two. So the next lines in the poem follow naturally. "While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors." So, yes, human faculties are sharp or dull, whether it's a matter of intelligence, eyesight, hearing, Some of those get duller as time goes on. Physical coordination, strength, musicality, a host of other abilities. We vary, we're different, you know. Each of us is a totally unique assemblage of characteristics, always changing and being changed by our environment. But we like to apply standards of evaluation, right, to ourselves. In other words, we're always comparing, rating. Exchange value, material value, spiritual, moral, aesthetic value, entertainment value, right? And these standards have their uses so long as we don't believe them to be fixed and absolute. So long as we don't use them in unjust and harmful ways. But Sherdo is telling us that in the Dharma, each one of us has equal value in our uniqueness and in our sameness. Each of us is a manifestation of Buddha nature. He drives his point home by saying that the way has no northern or southern ancestors. He lived in 8th century China. Seems like a long time ago, but some things haven't changed too much. At that time, Zen, or Chan, was becoming well known as a unique school that emphasized meditation and the direct experience of the reality of Buddha nature. But, of course, a sectarian split arose between the Northern school, which emphasized the gradual process of awakening, and the Southern school, which stressed that experience of enlightenment is sudden and immediate. Now, apparently, both schools taught both aspects of enlightenment, but disputes arose, as so often happens to this day in human organizations, including religious organizations. When members have a strong commitment and zeal, right, but it congeals into a narrow identity and doctrinaire thinking. So when he wrote this line, he must have had in mind the story of Hui Neng, the sixth Zen ancestor. So Zen ancestors are counted from Bodhidharma, who was an Indian monk who brought Zen to China, and then counting from there. So this was the sixth ancestor, who was a humble, illiterate woodcutter who lived in southern China. And southern China at that time was considered to be less developed and cultured than the north. And one day he was delivering firewood and he heard someone chanting the Diamond Sutra, and he had a sudden awakening experience. So he decided to travel north to find the fifth Chan patriarch, Hongren. And in the Platform Sutra, which is said to be written by him, or his words at least, he gives this account of his meeting with the fifth ancestor. So the patriarch asked me, "Who are you and what do you seek?" I replied, "Your disciple is a commoner from Xinzhou of Lingnan. I have traveled far to pay homage to you and seek nothing other than Buddhahood." "So you're from Lingnan. You're a barbarian. How can you expect to become a Buddha?" asked the patriarch. I replied, although people exist as northerners and southerners, in Buddha nature there is neither north nor south." So he went up to the fifth patriarch. And he stayed on at the monastery, chopping wood and working in the rice mill, apparently. And there's a wonderful story of how he came to be recognized as the successor to the fifth patriarch, but we'll have to save that for another time. But he was seen as an illiterate barbarian and mocked by the other monks. For now, I think it's enough to note that human tendency to divide self and whatever we include in our self-identity from other, what's outside, different. And to judge the other unfavorably based on those differences of gender, sexuality, skin color, appearance, ethnicity, class, religion, etc. Some of the most vicious conflicts in human history have come when differences in religion are conflated with political power structures. Irish Protestant versus Catholic. Christians, both Christians. Jewish Israelis versus Muslim Palestinians. Sunni Muslims versus Shia Muslims. Even Buddhists in Myanmar persecuting Muslim Rohingya. Religious doctrine can even be bent to justify such persecution. It's enough to put one off religion, isn't it? And to look towards the secular concept of justice for solutions to human suffering. But concepts of what constitutes justice and who is eligible for it have also varied through human history. Justice has to do with maintaining and restoring stability or equilibrium in human social relationships and organizations through ensuring right conduct and equality of resources and opportunity. But it depends on what moral standards and philosophical principles justice is based upon, right? And how it is carried out in practice really varies depending on cultural and societal and historical differences. Like all human social systems, justice systems, like religion, education, government, despite our best ideals, can be contaminated by the three poisons, what in Buddhism are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and ignorance. This is our human reality, our human imperfection. So we have to recognize that some of the strongest, clearest voices speaking out against human cruelty and injustice have come from the world's spiritual traditions. So maybe there is a way for spiritual practice and work for justice in the world to go hand in hand. Buddhism and Zen came to North America from strongly patriarchal cultures into a white, male-dominated culture, or cultures in the West. So of course the teachings and the way they were taught have been inflected by gender and racial bias played out often unconsciously in Sangha life. In the past 10 to 20 years, many more women Dharma teachers have been finding their voices, and even more recently, Dharma teachers of color have been published and having their say. So I want to include these voices and encourage you to seek them out in the coming weeks. I think I'll try and put a recommended reading list on the website posting for this this seminar. One teacher in our own lineage of Suzuki Roshi and the San Francisco Zen Center who directly inquires into the question of difference and unity is Zenju Earthland Manual in this book called The Way of Tenderness, Awakening Through Race, Sexuality, and Gender. She draws on her own experience as an African-American lesbian woman coming into predominantly white middle-class Buddhist and Zen sanghas and feeling deeply unseen and unheard. When her Zen teacher gave her the name Zenju, complete tenderness, she resisted it at first because she says, "I did not see myself as tender in the sense of being soft or gentle. I felt the raw and wounded kind of tenderness." But she embraced that Dharma name as a kind of koan, as a question to inquire into. So here are her words. "We must come through the fire of our lives to experience awakening. We are all tender, no matter where we fall on the continua within race, sexuality, and gender. We are tender in the raw sense and not necessarily in a soft and gentle way. This tenderness is of a wounded nature. We are all sore from the hatred. Our tenderness is our aching sensitivity and ultimately our vulnerability. This raw feeling is not only experienced by those who have been oppressed, abused, and discriminated against. Experiences of hatred, whether giving or receiving it, have no boundaries. The abuser or oppressor also experiences a wounded tenderness. One cannot hate without knowing the experience of it. After all, aren't those who are perceived to be dominant in our society hated too? Can we be tender in the raw sense and still actively walk the path of liberation? Tenderness, a liberated tenderness, is that is not a wound, but complete liberation from the rage that hatred breeds. I'm going to read that again. I left out the first half of the sentence. So how does someone who has experienced deep hatred from within as well as without become Zenju, complete tenderness, a liberated tenderness that is not a wound, but complete liberation from the rage that hatred breeds? So her book is the answer to that question. How can we transform that wounded tenderness to a liberated tenderness, an open-hearted tenderness? Isn't that what we all seek? You know, healing of those wounds that divide us from others and from our own completeness. So in the coming weeks, we'll inquire into the ways we separate ourselves from those who are different, or the ways that we feel cut off from those who perceive us as different. We'll look at the Buddhist and Zen traditions and see what they have to offer in the way of guidance, or we may find some parts of the tradition that are culture-bound and that get in the way that we need to let go of. And we'll look at how we can live fully awakened to difference and unity with an open, flexible mind and compassionate heart, neither becoming ensnared and caught in the web of our karmic lives, nor using oneness as a way to turn aside from the beautiful, painful, precious particularity of the person right in front of us, or to turn away from the systemic injustices of our social and political systems. This is the path of the Bodhisattva, the way of tenderness. So to undertake this inquiry, we'll need to be honest and accurate observers of our own experience and be willing to listen deeply to those who had different experiences, aware of the deeply shared roots in our humanity. We have to be willing to be vulnerable and to take risks. In this setting, we won't be able to go into as much depth as we could if this were a discussion group that everyone signed up for, because they said, "Oh, I wanna do that." We might have people walk through the door who might feel, "Well, I just came here to learn how to meditate and de-stress. Don't get political on me." Or someone who might feel, "I'm not so sure I feel safe enough to share some of the most painful parts of my life." So I want to set this up so that each of you can kind of step into these waters as far as you feel comfortable at any given time, and encourage you to go just a little deeper. But you don't have to jump in the deep end. And we're going to do our talking circle a little bit differently from what we do in our usual Dharma seminars, and I'll explain that in a bit. But I have some sort of questions to invite you to reflect on. And I didn't ask if somebody could bring in those papers and pens that I left on the table out there. I think one person can do it and pass them out. And sometimes it's helpful when you listen to these reflections is to make a few notes for yourself. And I encourage you, if you start coming to these Wednesday nights regularly, if you want to bring a notebook, to do so. You don't usually take notes during Dharma talks, but in the seminars are different, and you may take notes. And then I might ask you to do some written reflections. And these are not to share with others unless there's something that you feel comfortable sharing at some point. But just for yourselves. Are you passing pens around? Yeah, I don't know. I hope there's enough. And you'll have to kind of tear off sheets. There's not enough. Just make sure everybody has something to write on and write with. And if you're content just to do this, you know, in your mind without writing, that's fine. You can pass yours on to someone else. It's optional. But once you're all set, I'm just going to read some questions for you to consider. Okay, so I want you to just cast your mind back to your early life, probably childhood. See if you can remember the earliest time or an early time when you became aware of injustice. It might have been an experience of your own feeling of experiencing injustice, or someone close to you being treated in an unjust way. Or you might have observed someone else different from you being treated in an unjust way. Think back, what was your the earliest or an early experience? And then just use words. You don't have to write long sentences or anything. Just how did you feel? How did that experience make you feel? And the next question is, how did the attitudes of the adults around you, of your family or society, shape the way you understood that experience? What messages or lack of messages do you recall? How did that affect how you understood that experience? Okay, and one more question, which is, how did that early experience of injustice shape the way you see and respond to injustice later in life, how you perceive injustice? And has that perspective changed? Okay, so if you're still writing, that's okay. You know, we could probably each write a whole long essay or more about all this. This is just, as I say, just getting our feet wet a little bit. And here's what we're going to do. Often we form groups of three. Instead, we're going to divide the group in half, so that means about 10 in each group, and Michael is going to make a circle with half the group on that end of the room, and I'm going to make a circle with the other half on this end of the room. You don't know this yet. And, oh, I forgot to turn this off. Okay, and